I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today, an encore interview with former United States Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia. Senator Rockefeller and I had a wide-ranging conversation, including one of his top legislative priorities as a senator, national health care for the poor, disadvantaged, and elderly.
Thank you, Senator Rockefeller, for being a guest today on Like It Is.
I'm very happy to be here. This is our first chance to talk together, and I'm excited.
Thank you, sir, for joining me. We want to start first with health care and the Democratic platform insofar as health care is concerned. It's estimated that 37 million Americans are without health insurance. Your party platform says, in part, that all Americans should have universal access to quality, affordable health care, not as a privilege, but as a right. You're a major proponent of health care for all Americans. But with a federal budget deficit seemingly out of control, where will the money come from to fund a universal health care for all Americans?
What we're going to have to do is to spend a little bit of money to save a ton of money on the health care system we now have. We're spending, this year, Bob, we'll spend $820 billion in this country on health care. And virtually nobody disputes the fact that we're wasting about 25% of it. It's either inappropriate or unnecessary or both. I don't know what 25% of $820 billion is, but it's, you know, it's $150, $175 billion. Well, universal coverage for every man, woman, and child in this country to have health care. You know, every pregnant woman having health insurance so she get good prenatal care all the way through. Everybody, every homeless person, everybody. The total cost would be $30 billion. But just on the money you'd save, you could pay for it three times. You see what I mean? In other words, when you get a universal health care program and you start cost containment and you do all the things that you do under a good health care system and you save the money, you save that money every single year. So to me, the question is, can we afford? It's not can we afford to do it. It's that we can't afford not to do it. We are crazy not to be doing it. And we're the only industrialized country other than South Africa that doesn't already do this.
You've been critical of the administration plan that would offer basically tax credit for those without health care. Also, there have been proponents for small businesses as well as from the insurance company. What do you say to those particular individuals who oppose the health care plan?
Small business, I worry about small business, but we take care of them in our bill. In other words, you know, it's easy for some guy in the Senate to say, look, to somebody who owns a restaurant or owns a barbershop, you've got to give everybody health insurance. Well, health insurance is expensive. So it's easy to say that. The question is, can you make it possible so that that small, let's say, family business, maybe it's a grocery store, that they can, in fact, afford health insurance? And the answer is yes. And you know how you do it? You just subsidize it if you have to. In other words, if you've got to pay 25% or 40% of the cost of the health insurance for that small business for 5 years or 20 years or forever, then you go ahead and do it. You see, you make it possible through reforming health insurance and through subsidies to make it possible so that no small business can say, I want to buy health insurance, but I can't afford to. You do that by reforming health insurance and by giving people the tax breaks and the subsidies to be able to afford it.
Do you think Democratic presidential candidate Clinton will be able to get broad-based support in the United States Congress as well as the Senate for his particular plan that he's proposing?
This is going to sound stupid, Bob, but I think, well, I like to say when Bill Clinton gets elected, that he'll come to the Congress and we will fall all over ourselves to together pass a health care program. He and I have talked about it personally. People say that, well, he'll get it done the first 100 days. I think we'll have most of the details wrapped up in the first 100 days if he's elected president. But I guarantee you we'll have it the whole thing passed after the end of 1 year. I mean, it's one of the three top things he wants to do: education, jobs, and health care. And all of a sudden, everybody's going to have health insurance, and there won't be a single homeless person, a single rural person, nobody anywhere who doesn't have health insurance.
Let me speak about the war in Bosnia. Croats, Muslims, and Serbs, the reaction of the international community has been one of outrage and some instances disbelief, as images of dead infants being via television in our homes and shocking reports of death camps or concentration camps being operated in that war-torn country. What should be the policy of the United States toward Serbia?
You know, even as we're talking, it wasn't until last night, Bob, that I saw for the first time the television pictures of these concentration camps. And I'd seen the brief pictures of the kids who'd been shot, but you couldn't really see them. They were under sheets. But this was, I mean, I'm old enough to remember those shots of the Nazi concentration camps, and I was seeing the same thing all over again. There was the barbed wire. There were these tall, stick-like people with ribs sticking out all over the place. I mean, it was literally Auschwitz all over again. And I suddenly said, Jay, where have you been? I didn't know it was that bad. So that I think, I mean, that now I'm so outraged, I'm so angry, and frankly embarrassed that I didn't know how bad it was myself. That I think that what Bill Clinton called for, what the president now is going to do, he says, well, we're going to mobilize and, you know, help the UN. But I think as these pictures get around, you're probably going to see Europe and potentially the United States getting ready to go in and stop it, enforce the peace through the United Nations. And I kind of want that to happen very badly, because this literally was concentration camp stuff.
Should we commit military force to
I think we have to be prepared to do that, to enforce a peace, to prevent genocide, but we have to do it through the United Nations.
In another part of the world, in Africa, the people of Somalia are dying as we speak. Africa is facing one of its worst droughts in years. There, as in Bosnia, civil wars have ravaged that country and its people. Can the United States do more than it's presently doing to bring this situation under control?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, I come from a state where people generally resent foreign aid, foreign assistance, because West Virginia we have all kinds of our own problems. We're wondering, well, where's the United States for us? You know, where's the government helping us? But I think I've always voted for foreign aid. Most of our senators from our state haven't. I always have, because I think that where you have famine, and you mentioned Somalia, you mentioned some of those areas of Africa which are becoming, over the years now, just becoming more and more desert. They've just dried up and they're blowing away. So are the people. That you cannot be a country called America and turn your back. And we can have all the crises that we do have here at home, and all the problems trying to get the money to solve the crises that we do have here at home. But you stop being America if you turn your back and you stop making money, food, relief available to people, children in crisis.
Would you be in favor of a similar UN response in terms of intervening militarily in Somalia with 10 warring factions there going at each other? Would you be
Bob? I'm a little out of my depth now on that. On the 10 warring factions and should the UN? To what extent are they involved? In principle, that's what the UN has to do in this world. It has to keep the peace increasingly as we become the primary forces for keeping the peace less and less. We have to turn more and more to the United Nations. So that the principle of the United Nations being active there appeals to me very much. I'm less familiar with all the warring factions and the fighting history than I am with the starvation part of it.
One final point. Are you fearful that the United States is becoming the policeman of the world in terms of which skirmish to intervene and which skirmish not to intervene? Do you fear that we're becoming a policeman of the world?
Because you've just asked a question, which is hard because it's sort of the practical dimensions of our needs here at home versus the moral dimensions of our obligations overseas. And I guess the only way that I can fairly answer that is we got to do both. We got to do both. That even as we have record numbers of young people unemployed and, you know, just Los Angeles, all kinds of problems in my state of West Virginia that need attention, that we lose our soul as a country if we opt out of involvement in other parts of the world.
Well, let's talk about you. As a very wealthy young man 24 years ago, you joined VISTA in an anti-poverty program for Appalachia in Emmons, West Virginia. West Virginia is among the poorest states, and one of the poorest states in America. What lessons did you learn, a man of wealth? What lessons did you learn as a result of living and working among the poor of West Virginia?
I think the fact that I'd been born lucky, been born wealthy, Bob, that the only difference that made was that I always had the option not to do anything if I didn't want to. I guess I could explain it that way. I mean, you could sit back and just do nothing. But on the other hand, I'm a human being. And when I went to West Virginia as a VISTA volunteer, it wasn't my intention to stay there. I went because I didn't know anything about my country. And in fact, what I had been spending my time on was becoming a, quote, expert in Chinese and Japanese studies, and I wanted to be a diplomat or a scholar or something in the world of overseas. And in my mid-20s, a friend of mine who I'd worked with in the Peace Corps, which had opened my eyes, said to me, Jay, you don't know anything about your own country. You ought to do something in your own country. And West Virginia had been made really famous by the 1960 Kennedy presidential election, and I went there because I knew there were problems there. I only intended to go for a year, but there I found that I was working with people who, one, were incredibly wonderful, hardworking people who didn't have anywhere, obviously, the resources I grew up with, who were facing all kinds of obstacles. Life looked like it was kind of set against them. And I felt that here is something that I can do that maybe I can help. And that's just my human nature kicked in. And I decided that staying in West Virginia, putting my feet down, my roots down, and my emotions into West Virginia meant much more to me than being an expert, let's say, on Japan, some country 10,000 miles away. So there wasn't any magic moment, no sort of thunder and lightning, but it occurred to me, this is the work I need to be doing. This is the way I'm going to be fulfilled. This is the way I'm going to be able to help and be proud of my life. And so that was 28 years ago.
Let's come to the
It's press. Changed me in every way, Bob. Okay. I mean, it's changed me in every way. Or maybe it's changed me in no way. You know, maybe it just brought something out in me which was there, but which hadn't been exposed. I mean, I think with young people always, it's the theory of the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps doesn't do that much good for countries overseas. It does some, but what it does is great good for the young Americans who go overseas, and it changes them. And they come back and they go into public service, public health or teaching or whatever. Same thing with VISTA. VISTA volunteers, I could help a little bit in the community where I went, but the basic person who was helped was me. It made me grow. It made me feel a sense of new challenge and excitement. So, I mean, that's the parable. I mean, you think you give, but you receive.
I'm speaking with Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia. I'm Bob Franklin. The program, It's Like It Is. We're on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. The senator and I, we've been talking about health care, and we've talked about his life in West Virginia to a brief extent. I want to talk now about the American dream. It appears that the American dream is becoming harder and harder for the average American to realize. The U.S. Census report indicates that in the last 10 years, the poor got poor and the rich got richer. Unemployment among African Americans and Hispanics remain high. What is contributing to the demise of the American dream, and why is unemployment seemingly always higher in the African American and Hispanic communities than other communities, from your perspective?
I mean, to me, if people don't have hope, it's very hard to get through the day. I mean, when people get up in the morning, there's just got to be something out there during the course of the day or at the end of the day, or there's got to be some connection between what that day means to them and something that's good, that brings reward, that brings money, so put food on the table, that you know, sort of the deal that if you work hard in America, if you play by the rules and all of that, America's meant to work for you. Well, what we've discovered is that there are in the African-American community, in the Hispanic community, in the white community, there are millions and millions of people out there who are trying their very best and are trying to play by the rules, but the rules don't work for them. And that's when people get discouraged. I mean, it's my theory of Los Angeles, in the sense of South Central. You have to have a reason to do things, positive, constructive things. There's got to be some sense of hope out there. We've deserted our cities. For the last 12 years, American government, through President Reagan, President Bush, have basically said, you're on your own. You know, if you can't make it on your own, there's something wrong with you. Well, there's a lot of folks where I come from in West Virginia and where I used to come from in New York City that can't. And one reason they can't make it on their own, there's no jobs. There's just no jobs available. So it's fine to say you ought to be working. But if there's no work to be done, much less that you don't have the training for it, much less that you're afraid to go to your high school or your junior high school, you might get shot on the way to work. 60% of African-American mothers worry that their kid will be shot. Each day they worry their kid will be shot, 60%. So what it means is that we stopped investing in people about a dozen years ago, and we started investing in arms, armaments, and defense, and that all went very well, and people started going down. So that, and the African-American community, the Hispanic community, and a good deal of the white community in ignored places like West Virginia, where I come from, have paid the brunt of that. So poverty's gone up, discouragement's gone up, hostility's grown up. And in the meantime, the government, through the president, have decided they want to divide people. So they set white against black, rich against poor, business against labor, jobs against environment. So in other words, they just split everything rather than saying we're all in this together. They take the opposite approach. All I know is that there are thousands or hundreds and hundreds of things we can be doing in our cities. From just real complicated things like housing and training, serious training, and getting jobs in there, if you have to subsidize them to get them in there, to very little things like making sure that there's basketball that starts at midnight, you know, so that kids that are up real late have things to do. And as a government, we've decided we don't care about that, and that's the wrong decision. That's the legacy of the Reagan-Bush years. That's why I'm one of the reasons I'm a Democrat, Bob.
Okay. Let me piggyback on that point you made about divisiveness. In a speech to the Alabama Democratic Conference in Montgomery, Alabama, you spoke of returning from church and seeing four black men approach you. You said that you were frightened. You went on to say that what quiet conditioning of the last 12 years does. That's what quiet conditioning of the last 12 years does. Elaborate a little further on that, Doc.
Sure. I mean, it was, I think the thing you have to start with, all of us, whether we're white or black, we've got to be honest with ourselves, with each other. And I'm what I would call a classic public person who's you know, voted for every civil rights bill that my family has been involved with, you know, black education back to the beginning of the century. But then I noted the Los Angeles happened. And then I love music. I love classical music. And there's on 16th Street in Washington, there's a church called All Souls Church, wonderful church. And there's a great young African-American organist there by the name of Marvin Mills, who plays great music. And I went lots of Saturdays to listen to him play his organ music. And one of these evenings, I came out, and I was all by myself, and I was walking to my car. And this guy, Marvin Mills, teaches at Howard University. And I was just about to cross the street, and four sturdy young black youth came up to me. And I tensed. I was all by myself. This is an area near Adams Morgan where problems can develop in Washington, D.C., and I tensed. I mean, I just did. I just did. And so I turned around and I said, hi. And they said, what'd you think of the concert? And there are four music majors from Howard University who'd been to the same concert, you see. So what that said to me, Jay, you had the reaction of what our country has taught us to feel, the fear, and it had nothing to do with the reality. These were four people who'd seen me at the concert who wanted to find out what I thought about the music, how far we are apart, and how wrong that is, how unnecessary that is. And what I felt so ashamed after that, that I've just thought a whole lot about it, a whole lot about it, Bob.
Senator Rockefeller, recently I did an interview with women coal miners. They're from West Virginia. They cited historical examples of women's contributions to mining being omitted from some periodicals. They've embarked upon oral history as a way of telling some of their successes and some of their safety concerns, chief among them black lung disease. In the Coal Industry Retiree Health Benefit Act of 1992, does this act assist those miners affected by black lung disease?
Yes, if they're retired miners, no matter whether they have black lung, don't have black lung, have something else, they're helped by this health fund. For example, black lung, if you've been working in the coal mine 20 years, much less 40 years, 45 years, you've not just got black lung, but you've got so much going on wrong in your body. You've got so many broken bones, and you're probably taking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different kinds of pills before lunch. And black lung can help you in certain ways, but Medicare can help you in certain ways, but neither of them pay for prescription drugs. So that this was a covenant made between John L. Lewis, the first president of the Union, and Harry S. Truman back in the White House, that these miners were going to get pension funds and health funds, and that 3 years ago the health funds went broke. Nobody knew about it in the United States, and nobody seemed to particularly care about it. But I decided, you know, I was going to make sure that those health funds were made whole. And so I just fought for 3 years, and those health funds are now made whole.
Let me go back to my earlier point regarding 37 million Americans, a third of them children, are totally uninsured against accident or illness, that at least another 60 million are uninsured. The third point, the total annual medical tab of $750 billion, 18% of the gross national product, buys less care for the average American. How much of those statistics, and incidentally, they're compiled by the American Medical Association, how much of those statistics would you say directly affect those living below the poverty level in this country? Or does it have any, are there any correlations to those points?
Yeah, there can be, and there almost always is. Actually, a lot of, if you're on AFDC and you get Medicaid, of course, you have health care. I mean, Medicaid brings you health care. Problem with Medicaid is twofold. One, it's meant to cover 100% of the people who are eligible for it, but it covers less than half. It's just not enough money. Secondly, it's a terrible program. It doesn't reimburse physicians, doesn't reimburse hospitals, so physicians don't want to see you, hospitals don't want to take you. And what you got to do is you got to get rid of Medicaid. You've got to make a decent public program for people who don't work, who don't have jobs. And you got to make it a much, a program with good benefits that reimburses physicians so they will see you, and hospitals so that they will take you. And it's not that hard to do, Bob. I mean, healthcare is very complex, but reforming healthcare, to be quite honest, is something we could do here in 2 or 3 months of good hard work without much trouble. And as I say, it cost $30 billion to do, so you could do it over, let's say, 5 years. That would be $6 billion out of a $1.3 trillion budget. You know, don't tell me you can't find it. We can. And you just do that for 5 years, and you've got it. And then you start saving hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Everybody has health care. The world gets better for some people. But it affects drastically the poor. But frankly, now it affects pretty much everybody.
The state of Oregon proposed to the administration a health care plan that the administration said that it basically left out provisions for the handicapped. Are you optimistic about the plan such as Oregon has proposed?
Well, I mean, I can find some things to criticize, or people do, in the Oregon plan, but my basic feeling about the Oregon plan is that they're trying to do something to make their healthcare system work. Now, they penalize some folks. They sort of say no to some people. And that's tough stuff to do. On the other hand, we do that every day in America because we have 37 million Americans, as you say, that don't have any health insurance at all, so we're saying no to them automatically. We're rationing them out altogether. So, I mean, I applaud Oregon for trying as a state to do something about its health care problems. Because we've set up here, and again, this sounds political, but with President Reagan and George Bush, who don't care about health care, who haven't done anything about health care, who won't even take the subject seriously. And so states are going crazy. So some of them are trying to do something about it. So I applaud what they're doing, even though I recognize that what they're doing is controversial. But they're trying to do something about it.
There is that effort going on. My guest today has been United States Senator Jay Rockefeller IV of West Virginia. Thank you, Senator Rockefeller, for being a guest today on Like It Is.
Thank you, Bob.
My guest today on this Encore Like It Is program was former United States Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.